Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, some Ukrainians who fled their country have come to the U.S. We'll hear about a couple now living in the Midwest. Those without health insurance are often hit with huge medical bills. An analysis finds the cost often depends on which hospital is used. We'll talk about race with a man who trains social workers and others on the subject. School consolidation can have its benefits, but in many cases, it's controversial. We'll hear about two rural districts that might go that route. We'll also learn more about the dangers of toxic algae and the famous Old West lawman, Wyatt Earp. Born in Illinois, and he spent time in Peoria, the author of a new book will be along to tell us more. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, we'll have more on the sometimes huge medical bills the uninsured can rack up. Later, we'll hear about two rural school districts considering consolidation and a conversation about race, why it still divides us. Those stories and more ahead. More than 4.6 million Ukrainians have left their homes since the Russian military invaded almost 2 months ago. Many are in refugee camps or other living arrangements in Western European countries, but some have made it to the U.S., even the Midwest. Eric Schmid has the story of a couple who fled Ukraine to reunite with their son in St. Charles, Missouri, near St. Louis.
On a quiet cul-de-sac tucked behind the St. Charles Convention Center, a Ukrainian flag flutters outside one of the houses. The blue and yellow hues help the home stand out from its neighbors. Inside, we meet Volodymyr Zrybniak and his family.
Please come in. This is my parents.
My name is Viktor.
Volodymyr and his wife have lived in the area since 2011, but his parents, Viktor and Svetlana, have only been there about a month. They never expected they would need to leave Kharkiv, Ukraine, their home of 40 years. Viktor and Svetlana were like many Ukrainians and didn't think Russia would actually invade.
Deep in my heart, I did not want to believe that Russia would attack, because Russia had given assurances of fraternal help, but it all turned out to be a hoax.
He says they did prepare, stocking extra food and medicine, but hoped the war wouldn't affect them. Then shelling started to hit Kharkiv, which is less than an hour from the Russian border. Viktor says he and his wife were unable to leave their home on the seventh floor because the elevators in their building were disabled.
We were terrified of each attack, realizing that the next shelling could hit our house. There were several houses nearby that had already been destroyed.
In the early days of the invasion, Viktor and Svetlana stayed in close contact with their son Volodymyr, who worked with his sister to find any way to help their parents escape.
I never experienced such situations before when I was calling and contacting just random people and trying to arrange their evacuation.
A way out of the country eventually materialized in early March. Volodymyr says he called his parents with the news and told them they had an hour to pack. They grabbed essentials like documents and medicine and left mostly everything else behind.
It was very difficult for us to decide to escape from here because everything is there. Our life we lived, everything there, we left as it is.
On their way out of Kharkiv, Viktor says they saw the aftermath from Russia's attack, burned out cars and destroyed homes. But he says the most difficult part of the journey were the many military checkpoints they passed through on their journey west.
Documents were checked very carefully, and this, of course, slowed down our movement and introduced some nervousness because armed people were inspecting our documents.
It took 4 days to traverse from Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine to the western border with Hungary. That's about the same distance as St. Louis to Washington, D.C. Viktor says a weight lifted when they finally crossed the border.
We had saved our lives, escaped from the shelling. We had already begun to think about what lies ahead. It was no longer fear. It was hope.
4 days later, they arrived in Frankfurt to fly to Chicago where their son would be waiting. Volodymyr says he barely slept coordinating his parents' eight-day journey out of Ukraine because of the eight-hour time difference.
Never wish anyone to experience this. It's mentally draining. You want to be there and to do something physically, but you simply cannot be there.
While he's relieved his parents are under his roof now, Volodymyr says they still face challenges. He says their travel visa will expire in a matter of months, likely before it'll be safe to return to Ukraine.
I don't want to come to the point where I need to make a decision if I'm a rule follower or I am for the safety of my parents.
As a naturalized U.S. citizen, Volodymyr says he was encouraged when President Biden announced the U.S. would accept 100,000 refugees. He says he's frustrated now because it appears little has changed since the announcement.
We have a saying that if you said something, do it, or better, don't say this.
Volodymyr says his next priority is getting his two siblings and their families to the U.S. from the German refugee camps they're staying at right now. He adds most of the other Ukrainian families in St. Louis are in the same situation, either housing family members who managed to escape or waiting for a way to get them here. I'm Eric Schmid.
Midwestern lakes have become a hotbed for toxic algae blooms. The mini dead zones typically crop up during warmer months and are largely caused by fertilizer runoff from farms. The blooms can be lethal for animals and can cause serious health effects in humans as well. But as Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin reports, few Midwestern states regularly test algae blooms.
Mandy Miller was excited for her 30th birthday. Though it wasn't the trip to France she had originally planned, thanks to COVID, she had booked a weekend getaway to Lake Centralia in Illinois with her husband and their two friends.
We looked on Airbnb and found this great lake house by this is just beautiful, and it was dog friendly, which was a huge plus for us because we always want to bring our dog.
So in September of 2020, Mandy, her husband, and Zeus, their 115-pound golden retriever, loaded into the car and headed out of their home in St. Louis to Lake Centralia. It was an unseasonably warm day, and when they finally arrived, they barely unloaded the car before jumping in the lake. In a video Mandy's husband took from the sandy shore, she stands thigh-deep in the water, Zeus wading toward her. That night, Zeus started vomiting. Not terribly uncommon for dogs. But the next morning, he got worse. He was largely unresponsive and having constant seizures. Sitting next to her husband, Austin Elkins, Mandy recalls rushing Zeus to the nearest veterinarian, who advised them to take Zeus to a bigger facility further away.
And so we load him back into, on my beach towel, into the truck, and I remember driving with you there and just asking Zeus to hold on and that we were going to do everything we could to get him help. And when the seizures got progressively worse, I think you and I made eye contact and we started telling him that it was okay, that if he had to go, that he was loved and that he was a good boy. And eventually we just, when it became very clear that he had just moments left, pulled over and just held him until he was gone.
They were stunned. But having grown up in Nebraska, Austin says he was pretty sure he knew what had happened.
I had a suspicion early on that it had something to do with toxic algae because it was something in Nebraska that, like, especially in the summertime, lakes were getting closed all the time.
Zeus's symptoms were textbook for toxic algae poisoning. And within days, Mandy developed gastrointestinal issues, muscle aches, vomiting, and sores all over her body. When they returned to the lake house, Austin says it looked like someone had spilled neon green paint on the surface of the lake. They called the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, which tested the water for a toxin called microcystin. The EPA's recreational health guideline for microcystin is 8 parts per billion. The test at Lake Centralia came in at 41,000 parts per billion. But they never would have known that before being exposed, because Illinois doesn't regularly test for microcystin in all of its recreational lakes.
We're not seeing, you know, close to all the recreational water bodies in the state of Illinois being tested every year, and they're not tested necessarily every week throughout the summer either.
Anne Schechinger is with the Environmental Working Group, a research and advocacy nonprofit. She says testing for toxins like microcystin is really spotty across the Midwest, despite the region's propensity for blooms. Blue-green algae needs two things to form: warm temperatures and nutrients, namely phosphorus and nitrogen, which mostly come from fertilizer-laden farm fields.
We see algae blooms happening throughout all of the Midwestern states, and it's not a coincidence that these states also are very agriculture-heavy states.
And yet, states like Illinois, Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri don't regularly test for toxic algae. Schechinger says that's putting their residents and animals at a great health risk. She says more states should look to Nebraska's toxic algae testing program. It turns out a similar situation to Mandy and Austin's prompted that program, according to Mike Archer.
In 2004, we had gotten a report from a private residential development that a couple of dogs had been in the water of their lake and had died.
Archer, who runs the program, says during the summer months, they test all of Nebraska's main recreational lakes, 53 in total, once a week. They post the results publicly so residents can make sure it's safe to swim. But Archer says the program is costly. They collect about 1,200 samples per summer, and each sample costs about $20 to analyze. Many states don't have that level of funding available for such a comprehensive testing program. Kim Biggs is with the Illinois EPA.
We do not receive any general revenue funds from the state of Illinois, so we are reliant on grants from the federal government and other forms of funding.
Biggs says they recently received a federal grant, which will help them create an online dashboard for people to check recent test results before visiting a lake. Until that happens, Mandy says she won't be swimming in any bodies of water in Illinois.
We have to either, you know, increase testing and increase mitigation, or just be very accustomed to throwing the dice whenever you get into a body of water. I know that I'm certainly never going to do that again.
After all, she's got a new golden retriever to look after.
Midas? No, you know, stay, sir, stay. Good boy.
I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
A group of national nonprofits is suing the EPA for failing to enforce federal air quality laws in national parks and wilderness areas. Shayla Farzon reports Illinois and Missouri are among dozens of states that have not submitted federally mandated plans to the EPA.
The regional haze rule requires all states to submit plans to the EPA to improve air quality in national parks and wilderness areas. The deadline was last July. Stephanie Kodish is with the National Parks Conservation Association, one of four environmental nonprofits suing the EPA in federal court.
Many of these sources that are causing regional haze in our parks are the very sources that are disproportionately affecting communities near those sources.
EPA officials did not respond to a request for comment. I am Shayla Farzon.
You're listening to Statewide. People who don't have health insurance are getting hit with some big medical bills. A new analysis by member station WBEZ finds in the Chicago area, how much patients might pay depends on which hospital they go to. Because even if hospitals give some patients massive discounts, their policies don't apply to every provider. Kristen Schorsch has more on that story.
Maybe this has happened to you. You go to the hospital, and afterwards you get a bill. Another one comes. And then another. You end up with a bunch. That's what happened to Elma. Last September, she had intense, sharp pain in her stomach, and she didn't have health insurance. Elma knew her family couldn't afford it if she wound up in the hospital, so she avoided going until she couldn't take the pain anymore. In the middle of the night, she went to McNeil Hospital in Berwyn and wound up getting her gallbladder removed.
Immediately, she was worried about the bills. Immediately, she was wondering, how are we going to pay for this? It was present as soon as she woke up.
That's my translator. We're in Elma's living room in suburban Cicero. WBEZ is not providing Elma's full name because she's undocumented, and naming her could put her family in jeopardy. Elma takes us through her journey one bill at a time. Her trip to McNeil would cost more than $50,000. She wouldn't end up paying the whole amount. With the help of advocates, Elma would get a 100% discount from McNeil because of her low income. But remember those other bills? Elma got those too, from several other doctors who treated her. For surgery, anesthesia, totaling more than $8,000. It turns out where Elma had surgery has physicians who weren't employed by the hospital. They're independent. And McNeil's rules about giving financial relief to patients don't apply to all providers. Carrie Chapman is a Chicago legal aid attorney who advised Elma. She questions why hospital policies don't cover everyone who touches a patient, because the outcome can be huge bills for people who can least afford to pay.
It's like just enough money to be devastating to the patient and very little money for the health system to collect. Relatively speaking, it's less than a rounding error in their budget.
After all, Chapman argues, nonprofit hospitals like McNeil get what can be lucrative tax breaks for writing off how much it costs to treat uninsured and low-income patients. Yet these hospitals are filled with private providers who can directly bill patients. WBEZ found this is common across the Chicago area. For uninsured patients, what this all means is they could end up with more bills based purely on where they get care. And in an emergency, patients don't always have a choice. Here's why independent doctors are billing patients like Elma. For one, these doctors often don't get paid by the hospitals. And if hospitals demanded these doctors passed along the same discounts, it could hurt their recruitment efforts, especially small hospitals like St. Bernard and Inglewood on the south side, where nearly all providers are independent.
We couldn't tell the physician, listen, anybody who all comers, you have to do something for.
Marianne Graby is with St. Bernard.
You need these providers. These providers have to take care of these patients. It's much harder to garner anybody that isn't going to receive some kind of reimbursement for the work that they've done.
Doctors say they don't get the tax breaks that nonprofit hospitals do to discount care. Yet their rent is going up while they're getting paid less to treat patients. Dr. Jade Chohan is an independent head and neck surgeon in the Northwest suburbs.
It's hard to keep your doors open and be able to write off in the way that we used to.
Back in Elma's living room, she's been able to get some relief. Her bills have been erased or reduced. One was knocked down by more than $3,000 after WBEZ made inquiries. The biller disputes the timing. It's not clear how many other Elmas are out there because no one is comprehensively tracking this issue. I'm Kristen Schorsch.
There is more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford, and still ahead, facilitating conversations about race. That and more still to come. Governor J.B. Pritzker this week signed next year's state spending plan into law. The more than $46 billion budget uses one-time federal COVID relief money to pay down billions in outstanding debt. It also would replenish the state's rainy day fund and pay more than required toward the state pension debt. The governor says temporary and permanent tax breaks are coming.
Our state is in its strongest fiscal position in generations. And as a result, we are able to provide $1.8 billion in tax relief for our residents.
That relief includes some small savings for groceries and gasoline. Property owners could get a tax rebate check for as much as $300. Some Republicans have accused Pritzker of using one-time federal COVID relief money to prop up the budget in an election year. Also, Illinois families shopping for back-to-school supplies later this year could get a temporary tax break. Lawmakers passing a measure that would lower the state's sales tax to 1.25% for purchases, including shoes and clothes. The Senate sponsor Mike Hastings, a Democrat from Frankfort, says it would help families pay for what their kids need for the next school year.
Older kids, like my 6-year-old, for example, I mean, his shoes can cost anywhere from $20 to $100. If you get Nikes, they're expensive. If you get the, you know, just the regular generics, I mean, still, everything costs money these days.
The cut would only last from August 5th through the 14th if the governor signs the measure. Teachers would also get a tax credit of up to $500 toward classroom supplies. Jeremy Allen is a doctoral student in sociology and an instructor on race at SIU Carbondale. He does trainings for social workers and others in the helping professions, including those sponsored by Centerstone, a national mental health provider with offices in Illinois. He talked with reporter Maureen McKinney about his trainings and his own experiences with racism as a biracial individual.
What we're trying to do
is bring to the attention of practitioners, of counselors, of people who are in the business of helping people, perhaps some things that they weren't unaware of. In other words, you know, the numbers support the idea that people of color, people who are minoritized in various different ways, are often reluctant to go and seek help for the very things which minoritize them. So in terms of race, what we're talking about is the fact that Black folk, brown folk, non-white people are oftentimes reluctant to go and seek help for experiences that have made them, that have affected them negatively, for fear that they will not be taken seriously. It's very difficult to speak to somebody who doesn't understand the world in the same way that you understand the world. And past practices indicate that people tend to not take those types of complaints seriously. So why would a person of color want to, you know, go and talk to somebody and take the chance that person is going to, you know, re-aggravate that injury by asking questions or by dismissing the claims? And this obviously applies to any of the ways in which people are marginalized, right? This isn't exclusive to race. Also, I think it's important to understand racism in structural terms. An individual is an individual, and a person can be racist and not be racist. But the way our society was designed and developed and has been deployed over years, over centuries, right? Racism is baked into the original recipe and it's been refined ongoing. A person now in 2022 doesn't have to be racist, right? You can honestly say, no, I am not a racist individual. But that does not prevent people from being advantaged by a system which inherently is racist. It was designed that way and it works very well.
Tell me about your own experience with racism.
How much time you got? Because I'm 51 years old. To look at experiences of racism as if they are, you know, individual events which happen, right? I liken it to Lemony Snicket's a series of unfortunate events. It's not the way to look at it. I've existed since before my birth in a system which prioritizes the comfort, the desire, the profit, the wishes of one group at the expense of others. I'm a product of a biracial couple, right? My biological mother is white. My biological father was Black. I was born in 1970. Up until 1967, it was illegal for them to be married in 17 states. So it's not a matter of me being able to relate to you some experiences, right? What do you want to know about it? That there's millions, right? Myriad, my entire life, the arc of my existence has been in many ways defined by a society, both here and in the UK, which is where I'm originally from, which is based on the advantaging of one group of people at the expense of others. I can't really answer that question because it's constant and ongoing and has been for my entire existence. And, you know, obviously long before that as well, but I could only tell you about experiences that I've had.
Where did you grow up?
So I was born in the UK and lived in London until I was 13. And then I moved to Southern California and lived there until I was 28. And I moved to Southern Illinois and I've lived here since.
Tell me about the experiences you had in your formative years.
As a child of color adopted by a white family, I was something of, I'll stop short of saying an oddity, but something, you know, something different. Grew up in a white neighborhood, went to white schools, went to white churches. But it's always been obvious to me that, you know, I was different. Not only was I seen differently, I was treated differently. I was understood differently. Now, obviously within myself, that can cause somewhat of a rift, right? Like I had to come to the understanding that people who see me and meet me don't necessarily know about me, right? As is the case for all of us. But the assumptions that they arrive at are indeed, if not based on, you know, physical attributes, then certainly those physical attributes, i.e. race, contribute to their understanding of who I am. As a kid in 1970s and 1980s London, there wasn't racial harmony. There were problems. And then as a teenager in Los Angeles, I grew up in a suburb called Pasadena, and there were problems with law enforcement. There are problems with the way in which African-Americans, which is interesting, right? That terminology, because I'm not American and I've never been to Africa, but that was the way I've understood, right? Like I'm seen as a Black man, as an African-American. There were issues, structural issues in the way that African-American, young African-American men interacted with the authorities, right? If you will, the court system, policing, the school system, all those things. So I had to kind of negotiate my way through those. And there were some figures in my life who helped me negotiate that. That has shaped and brought me to where I am. I've long said that, you know, the ideas that I've had were in my head about race haven't changed, right? They haven't changed in the course of me pursuing this academic endeavor. I've just learned different language. I've learned more about the cause. I've learned different language to express, but I haven't changed, right? I've always known what this is, who I am, and, you know, where my place is and why that's problematic for some folks.
Can you tell me some examples of aggressions or microaggressions about your race?
Sure. So I'll give you an example that just happened while we've been talking, right? Your question in some ways could be construed as a microaggression, right? When you ask me to tell you about experiences of racism, right? That's a microaggression because it implies that they stop. And I don't think that that was, you know, deliberate on your part. I don't think that you were asking a question that you felt, you know, would be taken that way. But I want to be clear, right? Intention does not mitigate effect in any way, right? So being asked to relive an experience that was unpleasant, to explain that to somebody else is in a way a microaggression. And I mean, and then there are the typical ones that people of color are exposed to. And you know, this isn't to draw a direct comparison, but it's similar in the ways that, you know, women experience microaggressions based on gender, right? Like, it's, people have said to me in the past, oh, I'm surprised that, you know, you understood that. Like, well, you know, I'm a PhD student. Why would you be surprised? Or, you know, oh, why are you here in college when I went the first time as a younger man? Are you here to play basketball? I'm tall. You know, why would you think that was the case? Those sorts of things are, you know, can be very well-meaning. You know, maybe that the person that asked those types of questions, it never occurred to them that perhaps, you know, I was there on an academic scholarship, or, you know, it's genuine surprise on the part of instructors that, oh, you do understand that, huh? Almost like, you know, I belong here, right? So it's that sort of the idea that perhaps, you know, certain people don't think I belong in certain situations, right? In certain positions. So those, I think, are the things that I find most frustrating. And then professionally, right? You know, I teach a class here, and I've, you know, been standing to the side of the lectern waiting for the instructor who was running late to finish their lecture, only to have them turn to me and say, can I help you? No. Oh, well, why are you here? Why are you here? Right? Oh, you're here to teach a class? Oh, yeah, yeah, me too. I'm here to teach a class. Oh, right. It was clear to my students, even, you know, in that moment that instructor didn't see me as a fellow instructor, right? They thought that, I don't know what it is that they thought, but they certainly didn't view me as somebody there to do the same thing that they were there to do.
I apologize to you for framing my question that way, but it was a great example. And I
right. No, I mean, there's no apology necessary, Maureen. That's not why I said that, right? I brought it to your attention because in many cases, people don't know, right? In many cases, people don't know. Mm-hmm.
I think we have a racial rift. Do you agree? And can you speak to that and what might be done to help it?
Number one, there is a rift, but it's based on something that doesn't have any evidence to support it, right? The idea of race itself is a social construct. There is no genetic biological basis for the categories that we see in, you know, on forums or in popular understandings of what race is. In other words, there is no genetic material that is shared by everyone in one group that isn't shared by some members of another group. So we are taught to understand people in those ways. We are taught from a very early age to differentiate people based on those characteristics, which aren't exclusive to a group. They are what they are. So if you understand race in that way, then certainly our society could be seen as divided along racial lines. And certainly, historically, right, that's been the case. But when you understand race as a social construct, it becomes then, it becomes a little more difficult to see society divided along racial lines. There are many more things that we have in common with one another across these imaginary, these racial lines. And just so as we're clear, I'm not making the suggestion that these categories, that race isn't without consequence. That's where it's real. It's real in those consequences. And that's not my words. That's taken from a sociologist. But you have to understand that this is all constructed. So then the question for me anyway, as someone who studies this type of thing, is why? Why are these divisions, if you will, these groupings, why are these so essential? Why does it matter that I am a Black man and the next person standing next to me is not a Black man, and thus we are different? Well, historically, that was put into place, again, so that one group could advantage themselves based on the work of the other group. And if you look across the course of the country, even before the United States was the United States, this was what was put in place. It was put in place to exploit the labor of one group of people for the gain, the financial gain of another group of people who, in this country, owned that other group of people. And across the 400 some odd years that America has been this experiment that it's been only been in the last 60 or so that some form of legal segregation hasn't been the law of the land. So it should come as no surprise to anybody that, you know, for 300 and whatever, however many years it's been, right, segregation of these people with the purpose of advantaging one group at the expense of the other group has been the way things were done. And then to compound that problem, the people who were put in charge of making sure that that segregation stuck were then left in charge of the dismantling of that segregation. Obviously, that wasn't going to work. So we are living now in what could be termed the hangover of those years. So when people go, well, yeah, but my family didn't own slaves, and I understand that, but the people who came before you certainly benefited in ways that the people who, you know, were owned and doing the work did not.
Can I ask to hear some anecdotes about how this applies to people who are in social work or other caring professions?
Yeah. And it comes back to trying to figure out how to move forward. Obviously, things are not good now and haven't been. So I think in order to make things better, in order to move in that direction, because understand that this is a problem that was centuries in the making and the deployment and the development, it's not going to be fixed quickly. It's also incredibly complicated. The way in which structures interact with people, the way in which we are taught to understand things surrounds us, right? It's very intricate, and it's gonna take some time to unpack all that. It's gonna take some time to find a way to move forward from this. But the first thing we need to do is recognize that there's a problem. The woman that put me onto the grant, the one that asked if I'd be willing to do this, came to me and she said, you know, I want people to understand that racism is as important a problem as child abuse. And I said, there's a problem, right? In that we still are questioned as to whether racism exists, right? And then whether or not it's been, or to whom it's beneficial, right? Like, there's a question as to whether racism actually affects people of color. So until we can address that, we can't get to the point where it's universally understood as a problem, and then we can move towards, you know, eradication of the problem. The first step in solution of any problem is identification of that problem. I hope my trainings, the goal of my trainings is to draw attention to, you know, to help people connect the dots, to help them understand why is it that when you see, you know, a Black woman that comes to you as a client, and she tells you that she's tired, it doesn't mean that she didn't get enough sleep last night. She might not have gotten enough sleep last night, but that's not what she's saying. When a student comes to me and tells me, a young African-American woman, and tells me that she doesn't want to go see a counselor, even though she's drinking too much and she's trying to solve the problems of the entire world and falling asleep in class, she doesn't want to go see a counselor because her mother told her that depression is a white people's problem. We have to be able to overcome those sorts of things. And as a counselor, as a practitioner, as a social worker, as somebody who cares and wants to make a difference, you have to be aware of the structural barriers that are, you know, impeding this progress so that we can negotiate them, right? And once we've negotiated them, then perhaps we can start to dismantle them. And then we will have some progress towards moving forward. Because one of the things that's so insidious about racism in this society is that a lot of people in the dominant group particularly are unaware of the extent to which this impacts people, because they don't have to be. It doesn't occur to people because it doesn't have to occur to people. And that in and of itself is a form of privilege. I want people to feel comfortable in the trainings that I do, and, you know, yourself in conversations like this, to ask questions that you don't know the answers to, right? There's no judgment. There's no, I'm not looking down on people because they don't understand that structural racism impacts certain people and doesn't impact other people. I wouldn't expect them to know that. You know what I mean? We have to come to this open-minded on both sides. But then that's not to say that everybody's point of view is equal, right? It's not to say that I can listen to somebody who's never experienced racism then say, well, because I haven't experienced it, therefore it doesn't exist, because that's not how. When we're talking about privilege, right, because that's something that is addressed publicly, right? There are some things surrounding race, surrounding racism, that are in the topic, you know, in popular discourse now. And in most cases, the people that are discussing them don't fully or even at all understand what those things are. I would like people to think of things in terms like this, right? Privilege is the idea that because something isn't a problem for you, it isn't a problem for anybody else. That to me is what privilege is. It's not my problem. I don't see that as a problem. Thus, it must not be a problem for anybody else. When you think of things in terms of that, maybe it'll help people get to a point where they can realize that just because something isn't a problem for me doesn't mean it isn't a problem. And then, do I care? Should I care? Right? Or do I wait until it affects somebody that I do care about or myself?
That's Jeremy Allen, a doctoral student and instructor on race at SIU Carbondale. He conducts trainings for social workers and others, including those sponsored by the mental health provider Centerstone. And he spoke with Maureen McKinney. You're listening to Statewide. We have more to come. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, a famous Old West lawman and his ties to Illinois. A medic who saved hundreds of lives on D-Day has been honored. The Army has named the Rock Island Arsenal's health clinic the Woodson Health Clinic for Staff Sergeant Waverly Woodson, recipient of the Bronze Star and nominee for the Medal of Honor. Retired Lieutenant General Thomas James says Woodson was a member of the only African-American unit to storm the beach on June 6, 1944, and despite being seriously wounded himself, he worked to save his fellow soldiers.
Where do people like this come from? For over 30 hours, over 200 soldiers that were wounded were treated, many lives saved, and then stabilized off to the next echelon of care. I am honored to have been in the same Army with Waverly Woody Woodson.
After several days of medical treatment, he requested a return to the front lines. Congress is now considering awarding him the Medal of Honor. The Woodson Health Clinic on Arsenal Island in the Quad Cities serves hundreds of active duty soldiers and their families each week with primary care, mental health care, and physical therapy. And it also provides care to hundreds of civilians who work at the arsenal. Up next, a Batavia artist uses his pen to tell unique stories, but it's not the type of format you might expect. Yvonne Boos explains.
Chris Hodge is an art teacher and ink artist. His art journey started when he was a child. He works with different art mediums, including pencils. But Hodge says he prefers using ink because it dictates the drawing's destination.
Ink's a permanent thing. You know, when you put down a line of ink, there isn't really much going back from that. And you have to think of a creative way to incorporate all those mistakes. And sometimes those mistakes just stay there, too.
The mistakes may not be apparent to everyone. What does seem apparent are the stories he tells through his works. Hodge says he thinks of a story and then he transforms it into his art. He explains that sometimes the planning and narrative of the story is developed before he sits down to draw. Other times, it happens during the process.
And sometimes I'll actually look at old work and realize that there's a message there that I missed the entire time.
He did a piece called Old Man of the Earth. In this drawing, an older gentleman is coming out of the ground with trees growing out of his back. The character looks weary. Hodge confirms that observation, saying the old man feels misused and is awaking to address the issue. For his drawing Pollution, he explains how he wanted it to show the relationship between humans and the earth. He says sometimes humans are not good stewards of the earth. In this piece, the roots of the tree look like human lungs. He incorporates an old childhood memory about his aunt.
She had this device that she put in this hole in her neck that would help her talk. And I was terrified. And here she's a very sweet person. I'm sure she was a sweet person, but as a young child, I'm hearing this voice and it was very terrifying.
He says he added this wound to the tree as a tribute to his aunt. Hodge started using a ballpoint pen to draw in high school and says using the tool brought him comfort. He put it down for a few years, but says when he became a high school teacher, anxiety pushed him back to the old friend.
The supervised students who are working on homework, and I brought some paper with me and some pens. I had some pens with me, and I just wanted to do something that felt comforting, and the ink felt very comfortable.
While working as a teacher, he decided to go back to school, but art wasn't the focus.
As much as I wanted to pursue art and like really continue with the art, a friend of mine had applied to North Central College for their curriculum instruction plan, and that just worked really well with the schedule.
So he enrolled in that program. He'd already received his bachelor's degree in art education from North Central College. Hodge says although he likes to dabble in ink, he doesn't think he is cut out to be a tattoo artist. He has a couple of friends who do this, and he says at one time he considered it. He watched his friend ink a Marvel tattoo down the length of someone's arm, and he realized That wasn't something he wanted to sign up for.
I make mistakes and I make them work, but like, you're working on a human body, you know, like there's not much room for mistakes. I don't want to like fly by the seat of my pants on this. And like, you know, I'll be honest, it kind of freaked me out a little bit.
Instead, Hodge will continue to plaster his ink creations on paper and share them with his class and community. I'm Yvonne Booz.
It's not always easy to be a small school district. Limited resources, staff shortages, but two rural Northern Illinois districts think they have a solution that makes both of their lives easier. Consolidation. Peter Medlin brings us that story.
It's hard for smaller rural schools to recruit and retain teachers. In Seminac, between hiring challenges and early retirements during the pandemic, they find themselves short a high school science teacher. Mike Short is the president of the Seminac School Board, and he says that's a big deal, especially when those classes are supposed to include hands-on lab work.
We're able to provide the students an online curriculum for these science classes, but doing a science experiment virtually where you click with your mouse and move this beaker to that beaker and pour this vial into that one and watch the reaction happen on a computer screen in an animated drawing, it's nowhere near the same.
In Leland, they can't currently offer any AP classes to get students a jumpstart on college credit. But Short and Leland School Board President Claire Anderson say those are just a few challenges they could solve through a formal partnership. It's rare for school districts to reorganize, whether it be consolidation, annexation, or deactivation. It hasn't happened in the state at all in 3 years, since two other Northern Illinois rural schools, Paw Paw and Indian Creek, joined forces by deactivating Paw Paw's high school. Those schools were already working together before their official alliance, and the same is true with Seminac and Leland. Claire Anderson says they have a long history of collaboration dating back decades.
I, as a Leland high school student, went over for physics 25 years ago. It's not a new function for us.
Over the past few years, that relationship has only grown. Since 2019, they've also had a sports cooperative. That same year, the districts launched a formal study to see if something like consolidation could make a difference for their students. Since then, their study and committees say coming together could address each district's challenges like AP classes. They say it could also allow both districts to offer all-day pre-K, bring in-house special ed to Leland, and consistent JV sports teams to Seminac. In some consolidation cases, one or both schools are seeing declining enrollment. Short says that's not the case here, and that both districts are in a good financial place.
Both districts are able to approach it from a position of strength. Nobody is losing dozens of students a year and declining enrollment. Nobody's hemorrhaging money or buried in debt.
Claire Anderson at Leland says it's about long-term stability. State funding might be somewhat reliable now, but the pandemic and budget impasse taught them how to plan for volatility. They project over $1 million in financial benefits and a small decrease in property tax.
There's going to be quick gains that we get, but in 10 years, in 20 years, what kind of district can we be proud of that we're offering excellent student life and academics and still being really tax savvy with our taxpayers?
So what would consolidation actually look like? All of the buildings would still be in use to keep class sizes small. Seminac students would take a 10-minute drive to Leland for 2nd through 5th grades, then Leland students would ride to Seminac for 6th through high school. Transportation is one of the biggest concerns residents have raised. Short says he understands, but believes the schedule change is worth it. The other common question is about teachers, and Short and Anderson are adamant that no teachers or staff will lose their jobs if the consolidation goes through. Another question is just about the communities. How can they retain the legacy of both schools while building something new together? The shared history helps, and they've got a plan to keep both sports mascots. The middle school teams will retain Leland's Panthers, and the high school will use Seminac's Bobcat. It helps that they're both cats. The towns will vote in June on whether to approve the consolidation. If they vote yes on the referendum, the new school district will begin with the 2022-23 school year. Both Short and Anderson say they're confident residents will see the benefits. Their committee has been holding community meetings through the process and will continue up to the election. I'm Peter Medlin.
Before Wyatt Earp became a famous Wild West lawman at the OK Corral, he was a common crook in Peoria. Earp's checkered legacy in the River City is one topic of Dr. Vicki Loberg's new book, Peoria's Bad Habits, which highlights some of the city's less savory characters and events. Tim Shelley recently spoke with Loberg about Earp's time in Peoria.
He was a ne'er-do-well, actually, and they had bad things to say about him in the local newspaper. They called him a bummer, which is essentially another term for vagrant.
What exactly earned him that reputation?
Well, it goes back a ways. There were actually at one time probably three Earps in Peoria. The 1870 census shows his brother Virgil here as a bartender at a saloon in Bunker Hill, which was in the red light district. And Wyatt ran into trouble with the law out west. There are a couple different versions. One thought was that he was escaping an arrest warrant, that there was a warrant out for him for misappropriating money when he was the town marshal. He didn't put it in the school fund. And then there was another story that he stole a couple horses. So all of a sudden he appears in Peoria, likely attracted here because his older brother was here.
In Peoria at that time, just to set it, we're talking, what, late 1860s, early 1870s? It's kind of an infamous town, so to speak.
It was known as a wide-open frontier town, which is not uncommon during those years. It's very interesting, the Peoria directories list Wyatt Earp living in a brothel, Washington and Hamilton. It was Jane Haspel's brothel. There were many brothels. Peoria was kind of known for its red light district.
So what was Wyatt Earp doing in Peoria while he was here?
Getting in trouble. Some historians suggest that he was also a pimp, recruiting prostitutes. There's not a lot on that. He mainly appears in arrest records. Haspel's brothel was raided by one, I think his title was either Detective Gill or Sheriff Gill, and one of the prostitutes who was also arrested at that time turned state's evidence to reduce her sentence or her fine, and then later she was found dead. And, of course, there were rumors that, well, perhaps Wyatt Earp had something to do with that. He was here not very prominent again until another raid, and he was arrested with his brother. His one brother, Morgan, seemed to be around with him. The two of them seemed to be getting in trouble and arrested. And so there were another series of arrests. They went to court, and Wyatt requested a change of venue. And he got the court date was changed to another judge who had never tried one of these type cases before. So I suspect Wyatt knew that the previous judge would have perhaps given him a harsher sentence. But so they paid the fine, and they were done. And then during another arrest, they didn't pay the fine. And so they had to go to jail. And the newspapers really played that up, that he had to spend time in the calaboose and so forth. And eventually after that, it seems that Earp left Peoria and went on eventually to have his fame at the OK Corral. And of course, no one understands. The whole image of Earp is based on the 1950s TV show Life and Times of Wyatt Earp, played by the very handsome Hugh O'Brien. And you know the song that says, brave, courageous, and bold, long may his story be told. Not so much.
What can we take away from his time here? Was that what impact did that have on him later in life, or did it have an impact on him later in life?
Not that we could tell, he continued his association with prostitutes as he went further west, and supposedly was married to one that was mentioned there. I mainly limited my time to his time in Peoria, but it was amazing when you do read further ahead That was just his style of life. That was his lifestyle.
That's Dr. Vicki Loberg speaking with Tim Shelley about Wyatt Earp and her new book, Peoria's Bad Habits. That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. We're glad you could join us and be with us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find all of our episodes at our website. It's nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. And our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.